All right, before we start, so just a reminder that next week we're going to have 3 lab sessions, and hopefully everyone has signed up. If you haven't signed up, or if you don't know what your assignment is, to which lab you're supposed to go, come by the ITO, make sure that they've actually signed you up somewhere, okay? The times and locations are on the course website. So that's the labs. For the tutorials, everyone should be in the tutorial group by now. Could you raise your hand if you know your tutorial group? Okay, so it looks like everyone is all right. If you still haven't been assigned to a tutorial group, please go to the ITO as soon as you can. So by the way, tutorials for this course, they are quite important. It does make a big difference on the exam if you've gone to the tutorials or not. All right, so today we're going to be talking about naive Bayes. This is our first full-blown learning method. It's the first classification algorithm that we're going to discuss in detail. Everything up till now was sort of prep. So we briefly started talking about naive Bayes classification, and today we're going to go deeply into that. We're going to talk about the basic form of the Bayes classifier, the different components of the formula, and what role they play. I'll go through 2 examples of estimating and applying a Bayes classifier, one for discrete data and one for continuous data, so we see both kinds. And then in the end, we'll briefly talk about sort of the pros and cons of naive Bayes, because it's an interesting choice. So just as a reminder, what we're trying to do, the big goal here in the class, was we're trying to learn these predictor functions f, where you stick some data, so you stick some observations x into them, and they spit out the value of y, which is the class that you want to predict, or a real number if you're doing regression. So for naive Bayes, y is going to represent a class. So if you're doing spam, ham classification, there's only 2 possible values of y, ham and spam. The x is a d-dimensional vector. We talked about that in the thinking about data lectures, right? That's the representation of your input. So for an email, it's some sort of word frequency vector. For if you're classifying digits, it would be the individual pixel values, the black or white of each pixel. And we talked about the generic form of Bayes classifiers. The probabilistic classifiers. This is a family of classifiers that tries to compute the probability of a class given an observation. So assuming that you see an observation like that, these classifiers compute the probability for each one of the possible classes, so both ham and spam, or for each of the 10 digits if you're doing digit classification. Not all classifiers are probabilistic, but probabilistic classifiers are a large family of them. So Bayesian classifiers is a specific restriction of that family. So these are the probabilistic classifiers that try to estimate class probability from observation probabilities. So the big difference there is the probabilistic classifiers, it's a big family. It includes both generative and discriminative methods. So generative methods like naive Bayes, they try to estimate a model for each class. So for each class, they're going to model the entire population. So if you're, if you're doing the ham spam example, a generative classifier will try to construct a model of what all possible spammy emails could look like and what all possible hammy emails could look like, right? And typically, they're Bayesian in nature. So y is ham or spam, and probability x of y is a complete probability distribution over all possible emails, right? Note that you don't actually have to do that. There is a lot of probabilistic classifiers that compute p of y given x directly. They don't try to construct this model for each one of the classes. So I guess the The one that we're going to see in the course is the logistic classifier. It's a probabilistic classifier. It computes P of y given x directly without trying to estimate P of x given y. But we're doing this Bayesian one today. So, if you look at the formula, there's three basic components that we'll be talking about. So, the P of y, that's something that we will call the prior. So that is, think of it this way. Before you see any sort of observation, do you have any prior belief about the class memberships? So for example, if you know that on average, 9 out of 10 emails that you receive are spam, then you have a high prior belief in spam. So then the prior probability of spam would be 90%, right? So that is something that you can, that is basically your best guess about what class it is before you saw the data, before you saw the email, right? So that's the way to think about it. The class model, that's the generative part. This says that assuming this is spam, what is the probability that I would see X? And X is specific email contents, right? So assuming this email is spam, what is the probability that I would see words like investment opportunity in Nigeria, right? And likewise, you would do it for ham. Assuming that this email is a genuine non-spam email coming perhaps from your lecturer, what is the probability that it would have Nigerian investment opportunity and related words in the body, right? So that's the class model. The last part, which comes from Bayes' rule, is so this is Py, this is P of x given y, and this is an expression that represents P of x, right? So that's the probability of how likely or not likely is that email at all in my universe, right? So without regard to a particular class. So it's an interesting quantity. Technically, this is a constant. It doesn't depend on y, right? You're marginalizing out y's. You're summing out over all possible y's. It's P of x. It doesn't depend on y. So this is a number that's going to be the same for every class. Once I see an email, it's the same number for every class, right? So technically, if you want to classify if email is spam or ham, you don't even have to compute that, right? Because it's going to be the same number in both cases. So it's a constant. It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect your decision whether it's ham or spam. But it turns out that it actually plays a very important role in making predictions, the probabilities themselves, comparable. And we'll see that in the following slides. Okay. So, all right. So I guess we've already gone through the components, but let's sort of dwell on them again. Another example. P of y, the prior. So suppose you're a doctor and you're trying to, suppose you're trying to build an algorithm for automatically diagnosing people, and somebody comes in and they clearly have symptoms of a flu, right? And but they're very concerned that they have some exotic deadly flu, so the avian flu or something like that, right? So it's possible that their symptoms look a lot like avian flu. So that is P of x given y. It's possible that their symptoms are very probable if they were infected with avian flu. But the prior comes into play, and you know that a priori somebody coming in with a common cold is much more probable than somebody coming in with avian flu. So that's the role of the prior. P of x given y, again, that's assuming that they have avian flu, do their symptoms look plausible? Assuming they have common cold, do their symptoms look plausible? All right. Now let's. So the last bit is a normalizer, and that's this function. So I said it's a constant. So for a single instance, it doesn't affect the predicted class. But what it does do is it puts predictions across multiple individuals on the same scale. Okay? So how does it do that? Well, basically, this normalizer, it's the P of X, it's the probability of what is that observation X, regardless of the class. And the way it comes into play is if you sort of think about the following situation. So suppose I'm doing digit classification, right? And I have a few examples of sixes, and I have a few examples of threes. And then I have a three that somehow got garbled, malformed, right? So maybe as I was scanning, something went wrong with a scanning machine, and it blocked out half the bitmap, right? So this doesn't look like anybody wrote that. It just looks like a bug somewhere in the device. Okay, so just take a look at what's happening. So if you take this, if you take these digits and you sort of build and you build a model of what the sixes look like and what the threes look like, so this could be, you know, in some space, this is your representation of a six, and this is your representation of a three. So the interesting thing is an outlier would be an instance that lies very far from all the class labels, right? So it's still probably closer to three than it is to six. But there is a lot of sixes that are closer to this model of three than this thing, right? Why is that? That's because the probability of observing this bitmap would be very low, right? It doesn't look like any of the other threes. It doesn't look like the sixes either. But it doesn't look like a threes. That means it's very, very far. So it's very far from every single class. It's closer to three, so the classification would be correct. If you didn't use the normalizer, it would still be classified as a three. But it would be classified as a three with lower probability than this six. Okay? If you want to keep all the probabilities normalized, that's what the normalizer is going to do for you. So what is it going to do? The normalizer is going to, it's the average of the probabilities under all classes. So it's going to say, what is the probability of that under 3, under 6, under 5, under 4, and so on. And all of those are going to be very, very small numbers. You add them up, you get a very small number. And then you divide by that small number, and that's going to raise all the probabilities up. Does that make sense? Right. So an outlier, which is not plausible under any of the classes, the denominator for it is going to be very small. And that's going to raise the posterior probability and make it comparable to the genuine threes and the sixes. So that's the role of the normalizer. Okay. So we briefly talked naive Bayes. It's a generative model. So again, it's something that you're going to construct a probability for. So for each class, you're going to construct a probability distribution over all possible instances. And as I said, something like a log linear model or a logistic doesn't do that. So a logistic, if you have the two classes, it will focus all of its modeling efforts on this boundary between the two classes. Whereas a generative classifier like naive Bayes tries to model the whole population. So why would you pick one over the other? Well, discriminative classifiers, they tend to be, so given the same amount of, given a sufficient amount of training data, they will generally be more accurate. They don't waste their efforts on modeling the parts of the boundary that you don't need. So they focus just on separating the black from the white. That's the way to think about it. Generative classifiers, they're more useful if you have lots of unlabeled data. They're also useful if you don't know from the start what it is that you want to predict, if you don't know what all the classes are. So it helps to build generative models in that case. All right. So what we went through up till now, that was the Bayes classifier. That was not naive, right? So right now we're going to talk about the part that makes it naive. The part that makes it naive is the independence assumption, right? So remember, as part of this classifier, we have to compute probability of X given Y. Now, X is our observation. So that's an email or a bitmap that represents a particular digit. It's not a single number. It's usually some sort of a it's an entire vector of d dimensions, right? So And generally, what you want to realize is that what Naive Bayes tries to do is it tries to count these observations. So if you have ham and spam, for ham, it's going to count how many times did I see emails like that. That's what you want to do in some way. And how many times did I see emails like that for the spam class? Now, and the problem, of course, if you take X1 through XD as a single sort of unit, right, if you take that as a string, you're not going to get very many repetitions. In fact, you're probably not going to get the same email twice. You always get a slight variation. So if you do counts of the entire email, all of the counts are going to be one or zero. So that's not very helpful. What you want, you can't generalize from that. So, and the same thing happens if you're trying to classify digits. So just think about a simple case, 20 by 20 black and white digit. So that's 400 pixels. That's 2 to the 400 possible combinations. If you were to count each one of them separately, you wouldn't have enough atoms in the universe to store those counts. That's a very large number. In order to count something, you make some sort of a simplifying assumption. And what you do in Naive Bayes is that you assume that the individual dimensions of the representation are conditionally independent of each other. So we'll talk about what that means on the next slide. But the practical outcome of that means that I don't have to count entire emails. I can count individual words separately from each other. So I can count how many times did that word occur in ham emails, how many times did it occur in the spam emails. Likewise, for the digits, I don't have to count entire bitmaps. I can count how many times was the top left pixel black, how many times was the top left pixel white for class 0, for class 1, for class 2, and so on. So this independence assumption allows me to move away from counting entire bitmaps and do counting of the individual attributes of the individual pixels. Mathematically, what it does is it converts a joint distribution over X1 to XD into just a product of the marginals. And an interesting step, so I'm doing it in two steps. Here, what I'm doing is I'm just applying chain rule, right? So I want probability for X1 to XD, and I'm saying it's the probability of XI conditioned on all the X's that came before it, like X1 through XI minus 1. Given away. So this is an exact decomposition. So to go from here to here, I don't need to assume anything. So this always holds. But to take this step, this is the independence assumption. What is it saying? It's saying that if I know Y, if I know the class, then I don't need to condition the probability of XI on any of the other X's. So in practical terms, what does that mean? If I know that this is digit 3, and I want to know what is the probability that this point is black, the blackness of that point doesn't depend on blackness of any other points, as long as I know that this is 3, okay? So it's, you can obviously see cases where this will go wrong, but it's an assumption, and it seems like a reasonable assumption, at least to some degree, right? Okay, so let's talk about conditional independence. Conditional independence is quite often mixed up with regular independence. They're different things, really. Let's take a single example. So suppose I have two events. Event number one, I went to the beach. Event number two, I got a heat stroke. Right. So are those dependent or independent? Well, they're clearly dependent, right? You expect them to occur together more often than separately. People don't get heat strokes sort of randomly. There has to be some causes. So these two are related. They would co-occur by chance much more than you would expect normally. In general, it wouldn't be reasonable to assume that they're independent, but you can assume that they're independent if there is some underlying factor that influences both of them. And that's what conditional independence is all about. So suppose that I have another factor in this whole system. H tells me whether the weather is hot today or not, right? So if I know whether the weather is hot or not, then the events of going to the beach and the event of getting a heat stroke are actually fairly independent of each other, right? Do you see why that is happening? So it's not me being at the beach that causes the heat stroke. It's the hot weather, right? I can go to the beach in the cold weather and not get a heat stroke. I cannot go to the beach in hot weather and still get a heat stroke, right? But if the weather is hot, I'm also more likely to go to the beach because it's nice, okay? So this H, the hot weather, you can sort of treat it as an explanation for the observations that you have. And if you have a situation like that, then you can, in good faith, assume that going to the beach and getting a heat stroke and the fact that the icicle melts in your hand, they're all independent of each other, right? Because they're all caused by a single condition, right? If the weather is hot, they all have a higher chance of happening. If the weather is not hot, they all have a much lower chance of happening, okay? So that's what conditional independence is all about. It's not that B is independent of S. It's that they're independent, assuming that you have this explanation. So how does that translate to classification? In classification, what you are assuming, and specifically naive Bayes, you're assuming that the class variable, the Y, the value of Y, whether it's ham or spam, or the digit type, that is your explaining factor. Whether it's ham or spam tells you everything about the dependencies between the words. Which value of the digit it is tells you everything about the dependencies between the pixels, whether the pixels are black or white, right? So it's a very different notion from complete independence. All right, so that was a general overview of naive Bayes classifier. Let's do two examples. We're going to do one continuous example and one discrete example. So for a continuous example, suppose you have this artificial task. You've got a collection of individuals, and you want to separate adult individuals from child individuals. And these don't have to be humans, right? And you're going to use two attributes to represent the individuals. You're going to represent the height in centimeters, and you're going to represent the weight. So you don't know anything else about any of the points, and you want to separate the adults from children. So your training examples are going to look like that. So for each, you're going to have a certain number of examples. Each example is going to be the height, the weight, and the class. YI is just A for adult and C for child. Suppose you have 4 adults and 12 children. So how do you estimate a naive Bayes classifier for that example? So we talked about the height and the weight. They're real numbers, they're numeric attributes. So a good way, a sort of a standard way to model them, unless you have some other prior information, is to use a Gaussian. So we're going to build a naive Bayes classifier with Gaussians. So how do we do that? Remember, the first part of the classifier is the prior. What is my prior probability that this is an adult and this is a child? Okay. And that is easy. We can compute the priors in this case without seeing any of the data, right? Knowing that we have 4 adults and 12 children means that a priori, there's lots more children in this data set, right? So a priori, your probability for a child is 3 out of 4, 75%. And adults are just a quarter of the population. Okay, so now we've got the priors. Now we want to be a little bit more specific. We want to construct a model of what the adults look like and what the children look like. And because we are modeling things with Gaussians, the simplest case is we're just going to use a single Gaussian for adults and a single Gaussian for children. So now suppose you just had the height, right? So you didn't have two variables. If you just had the height, how would you model that with a Gaussian? In the previous lecture or two lectures back, we talked about the maximum likelihood estimate for a Gaussian, right? How do you fit a Gaussian to the data? So you have a few heights observations, and we talked about how do you get the best possible Gaussian to fit those points. you have to compute, Gaussian has a mean and a variance. How do you compute the mean? Well, you take the points and you just add them up and divide by n, so you average them up. So that's what you do here. The mean of the heights, let's say for adults, is going to be the sum of the four heights for adults that you have in your data set. Very simple. You compute the variance by using just the simple sample variance, and note that this is actually a biased estimate, right? If you want it to be unbiased, you'd use one third here instead of one quarter. But this is fairly straightforward. So you got the mean, you subtract the mean from each one of the heights, you square it, and you average it out, and that gives you an estimate for the variance. So that is my model for adults, for adult heights, right? Just a single Gaussian. I can do the same for the weights and get another Gaussian. And then, because we are naive, because this is naive-based classifier, what you can do is we will actually multiply one Gaussian by another Gaussian, right? Because we're assuming that the height and the weight are independent of each other. No, not independent, conditionally independent, right? So whether the individual is an adult or a child explains all the difference, all the correlation between height and weight. That's what we're assuming. So we're just going to multiply them together. So that creates our model for an adult. It has two Gaussians, the Gaussian for the height, the Gaussian for the weight. And we'll do the same thing for the children. So let's actually look at this graphically to see what it would look like. So these are our 16 individuals. This is their height in centimeters. This is their weight in kilos. And let's suppose that the red points are adults and the black points are children. So what does it mean, this estimation that we talked about on the previous slide, what does it look like graphically? So let's do the height for the children first. So how do you do that? You take each point that is a child and you essentially drop it down to this axis, right? So you take the height component. If you just drop them all down to this axis, you'll get this sort of distribution over them, right? And then all you're doing is you're estimating the mean and the variance by adding up these heights and dividing by 12, right? So that's going to give you the mean. And then the variance is how far away those things are from the mean, right? So this is the height component of my model for children. I can do the same thing for weight. So again, that's taking those points and sort of dropping them on the y-axis. You get a little histogram, and then we're fitting a Gaussian to that histogram very simply by adding up the weights. The average weight then becomes the mean of the Gaussian, and the difference around that average weight becomes the variance of the Gaussian, right? Simple enough. So what is the overall model? So this is the model for the height of children. This is the model for the weight of children. The overall model is the product of these two Gaussians, and that's going to be an elliptical but axis-aligned Gaussian, right? So if you think back to the previous lecture, that's like the Gaussian with a diagonal covariance matrix. You can stretch it horizontally or vertically, but you can't turn it. It always has to be sort of aligned to the x and y, right? So just think of it as sort of a bump rising from the data. So what does it mean? It means that points closer to the center of this bump are more probable as children. Points that are further away from this bump are more probable as adults. I shouldn't say more probable as adults. They're less probable to be children. They're two different things. And I'll actually tell you what they are. So the red ones, that's an example. This is what you would get if you did the same thing for adults, right? So I'm doing the Gaussian for the height, Gaussian for the weight, and just multiplying them together. So now I've got these two bumps. The closer I am to the center of each bump, the more likely I am to be sort of an instance of that class. And this is an interesting example where you can think about the difference between generative and discriminative classifiers, right? So suppose I have a point right here at the origin. And think about what would the discriminative classifier and a generative classifier do? So So I got a bunch of adults here. I got a bunch of children in here. This is my Gaussian model of adults. This is a Gaussian model of children. This is a generative classifier. You're modeling each population. In a discriminative classifier, instead of these bumps, you would draw some sort of a decision boundary between the two and say things on one side are adults and things on the other side are children. Now, suppose that I gave you a point right here and asked you, is that a child or is that an adult? The discriminative classifier would be very confident that this is a child because it lies on this side of the boundary and it's actually really far from the boundary. So there's no chance that this is accidentally an adult. So a discriminative classifier will say, oh, for sure, this is a child. A generative classifier will say, well, it's certainly not an adult. Right? It's very far away. But in all honesty, it doesn't look like a child either. It's quite far from that Gaussian as well. So I'm just putting that as a possible connection for the difference between the two. Okay. So, but let's get back to this example. So we estimated the the Gaussians for adult instances and child instances. And then if I give you a new point, then how would you compute? So this is a new example. I don't know if it's an adult or a child. How do you compute the probability that it's an adult or a child? And that's fairly simple. So again, you start with the priors. We already know what they are. You know. A priori, 3/4 should be children. Then what we're going to do is we're going to compute how probable is that height under the model of children, right? So what does that mean? That means taking the height value, looking at this Gaussian, and seeing how high is it at that point. That's going to tell me, does that look like a typical child height? And in this case, yeah, it looks like a typical child height. And by the way, the equation there, that's just the equation for the Gaussian. So don't be scared off. They're all the same. All the equations are the same. I'm just repeating the Gaussian n times over and over. Right? So this looks like the right height for a child. Next, you look for the weight. Now, the weight is a little bit different story. So on this Gaussian, the weight is fairly far out from the mean, so this doesn't look like a typical weight for the child. Then I'm going to do the same things for adults. So I'm going to take this point, and I'm going to say, does that look like a typical weight for an adult? Yes, it does. Does that look like a typical height for an adult? No, it doesn't. And the decisions, you know, I'm saying yes, it does, no, it doesn't. They're not binary, right? You always get a number. You get a probability. What is the probability of that height given that it's a child? Okay. And then what am I going to do? Then I'm going to compute the probability that of that observation, both weight and height together, given that the class is an adult and given that the class is a child. And how do I do that? Well, it's naive base. I'm assuming conditional independence given the class. So I just multiply together the two probabilities. Right. So for those of you who know the difference between probability mass functions and probability density functions, you also know why the DH and DW are in there. If you don't, then just ignore them. Pretend that they're not there. So that basically, this number, that tells me, if this was an adult, what would be the probability of seeing that particular height and weight pair? And then I can use Bayes' rule to convert that to what I really want. What I really want is what is the probability that that point is an adult or a child? And that's just the probability that I would observe it in the adult class times the prior of the adult, which is 1/4, divided by the normalizer. And the normalizer, that's the thing that's going to put things on the same scale. And if I didn't use the normalizer, then I could actually say, well, look, this is a pretty odd individual. it doesn't look either like a child or like an adult. It's a teenager of that species, perhaps. All right, so that was naive Bayes for numeric data. Now, everything is fine and dandy, but it turns out that there's a couple of interesting problems with naive Bayes. So the first one, let's just look at this. So suppose you had a data set like that, right? And you wanted to model that using naive Bayes. So this is my one class. Maybe this is people that I should give. I'm a bank and I'm deciding to give money, to loan money to people. So these are the people I should lend money to in terms of these two attributes, and I'm not specifying what they are. So I decide to model that with naive Bayes using Gaussians. So what would I do? First, let's model the first attribute. Maybe that's the amount of money that, well, I don't know. So I model this first attribute, I get a Gaussian. I model the second attribute, I get a second Gaussian. It's naive Bayes, so I'm going to multiply together the two Gaussians and overall get this sort of circular structure. So it's a bump, sort of equally elongated along both directions, right? So all good and fine. So these are all my positive examples. These are the people that I want to lend money to. And let's say these are people that I don't want to lend money to. Okay? So it's certainly a different population. It looks very different, right? Even in terms of those attributes. You should be able to separate the two. But let's see what naive Bayes is going to do for them, right? So let's estimate the Gaussian for the first attribute and for the second attribute. And you see that, oh goodness, they kind of look the same. Why do they look the same? Well, because if you take all the points and you drop that down, they actually form very similar distributions on each attribute individually, right? So just imagine dropping all the points down to this axis and then dropping them all to this axis, and then you'll see that individually, the two Gaussians are very similar, right? For the people that I do want to lend money to and don't want to lend money to. So if I use naive Bayes for this example, I have no hope of ever distinguishing people that will repay the loan from people who won't repay the loan, even though the attributes tell me something about the data, okay? So this is a well-known problem with naive Bayes classifier. It comes back to the independence assumption. So remember, what is the conditional independence? It says the class encodes all of the dependencies between the data points. So if you know the class, you don't need to model dependencies. Well, in this case, the only difference between the two populations are the kind of dependency that they have in these attributes. In one case, it's positive correlation. In another case, it's negative correlation. So if you don't model the dependencies, you have no way of capturing the difference between the two populations. OK, so let's look at a discrete example. So spam classification. Suppose that I had, suppose that these are my training instances. So somebody gives me 6 emails and 4 of them are spam and 2 of them are ham. And I want to do spam classification based on that using naive Bayes. How do I do that? Well, so again, you start with priors. What are the priors in this case? The probability of spam is 4 out of 6. Probability of ham is 2 out of 6. The next thing I have to do is I have to build the models. The models of what it means to be a spammy email or a hammy email. So what do these models look like? We talked about the way we would represent text, right? The way you represent text is you take all the words and each word becomes an attribute and the value is 0 if the word is present in an email and, 1 if the word is present and 0 if the word is not present. So let's look at that. So say the word password, right? The word password occurs in 1, 2 spam emails, so the probability of observing password in the spam class is 2 out of 4. Because out of 4 spam emails, 2 contain it and 2 don't contain it. Okay? So 2 out of 4 is the probability of password given spam. That, of course, is the same as a half. In the ham class, only 1 email contains a password, and that's 1 out of 2 hammy emails. So the probability of seeing password is the same in the ham emails and spam emails, even though the counts are different. Okay? Then you repeat the same process for each one of the words, and it's fairly straightforward, except for the last one. So the word account is interesting because we observe it once in the spammy emails, but we don't ever see it in the hammy emails. And that, it, that will lead to a certain problem that we'll talk about solving a little bit later on, right? So the probability for seeing a count in spam would be 0.25, and the probability for seeing a count in ham would be 0, exactly. So that's our model. This defines a model of the spam class. That's what the spam emails look like. This is the model of the ham class. That's what the good emails look like in terms of the individual word occurrences. Okay. Now suppose you get this new email, and the email says, review us now. So how do you compute the probability that whether this is ham or spam? So something that will be in the following slides. So you see a word now. This is a word that we've never seen before. So this is an example of missing data. It's a very interesting problem. And it turns out that for naive Bayes, the way you deal with missing data is very simply. You can throw it away and pretend it never happened. Right? So if you see a word that you never saw before, you just throw it away and everything works out fine. It doesn't work out that way for the other classifiers, but for naive Bayes it does, and I'll talk about a bit about why. So the words that are left are review us. Right? So let's see, what is the probability that email review us would come from spam? So let's just walk through that. So what is the representation of that? Right? The representation has to be in terms of these, in terms of all of these words. So let's look at them one by one. The word password, it does not occur in that email. So the value is 0. The word review does occur in the email, right? That's it right there. So the value is 1. Send doesn't. Us gets a value of 1. Your gets a value of 0. And account gets a value of 0 because none of those words are present in the email. If you're not present, you get a value of 0. Okay? Otherwise, you get a value of 1. So now, what is the probability of that sequence in the spam class? It's naive Bayes, so you assume that the individual bits are independent of each other. So the way you compute the joint probability is just multiplying together individual ones, right? So let's look at that. So let's look at this one first. The word review, right? We're in the spam class. The probability of review in spam is 1/4. So that's our 1/4. Now, the word password was not in the email. So instead of taking 2 out of 4, instead of taking 2/4, I take 1 minus 2/4. Does that make sense? Right? It's 1 minus that because the word password did not occur in the email. Same thing for the word send, right? The word send happens in 3 out of 4 emails, but it didn't happen here. It didn't happen in this email, so it's a 0, so I take 1 minus 3/4 as the probability of not seeing send in a spam class, okay? Continue on, multiply all of those things together, you get a certain number. So you do it for spam, then you do the same exact thing for ham. Same exact thing. It's the same sequence, so I'm going to have 1 minus something here and something here and then 1 minus something here. Only now the probabilities are not from this column, they're from this column. So for password, I get 1/2, so 1 minus 1/2. For review, I get 2 out of 2. Review. That's lovely. So, that's 2 out of 2. Sorry, I looked at the wrong one. Then send didn't occur, so it's 1 minus 1/2, 1 minus 1/2, okay? So, again, multiplying them together, get a big number. And then, to calculate the probability whether this is ham or spam, what you do is you apply Bayes' rule. So you take the, this must be the lower part, so this is the probability of that email, given that it's a ham class, so it's just a product of all of those things, multiplied by the prior probability of a ham, and that's of course 2 out of 6, okay? And what you have on the bottom is the same thing plus the joint probability of the email with spam. And if you go through all that, you get a number which is 0.87. Now, there's something, so that's a number that basically says that the probability of ham is 87%. So the probability that this email is spam is what? Yeah, 1 minus that. So that's just 13%. So this email is definitely ham, according to Bayes. And the curious thing that you should notice is, we did actually see this email before. It wasn't quite exactly the same email. It didn't have this word, but the representation is identical to D4. Okay, and D4 was spam. So this is something that Naive Bayes will do. Even if you saw something exactly like this email in the past, and it was labeled as spam, it doesn't mean that the Naive Bayes will predict spam for it. Why? Because it's generalizing in a different way. What it's saying is the distribution of words in this email looks hammy. Even if you had a single spam example in the past that looks exactly like that, the overall statistics of words say that this looks more like ham than spam. Okay, so that's just something to be aware of. This happens with Naive Bayes all the time. Okay, so when you do Naive Bayes for discrete data, so for text, for bio, anytime you have counts, anytime you have discrete things, the problem with Naive Bayes is if you ever get a zero count, that's a really big issue. So if we go back to here, when we estimated those probabilities, the word account never occurred in the ham class, right? So what does that mean? That means that any email you send, if it has the word account, what is that going to be classified as? Spam. Always spam. It doesn't matter what the rest of the email is. Why? Because the probability of a count in ham is zero. And as soon as you have one zero in this product, the whole number is going to be zero. So that is known as the zero frequency problem. As soon as you have one attribute with a zero frequency, the entire product turns into nil. And that causes problems. So the solution to that is that you never allow zero probabilities in your models. You never allow zero counts. How do you do that? Well, the simplest way you could do it is, the solution is sometimes called smoothing or shrinkage. The way you do that is when you're counting how many times did I see that word in that class, you add a very small number epsilon to all counts. And in this case, when you're normalizing things to sum to one, you also have to change the normalization factor so that all the probabilities add up to one, right? So that would be, in a binary class, you add two epsilon to everything. That ensures that the word account or any other word will never have a zero probability. It'll always have a probability of at least epsilon. So if it has, epsilon is a small number, but maybe there's lots of other hammy words that will pull the email back into ham. And that's something that you want to do. So you're thinking about this and saying, how common is that? I mean, is that going to be a problem? Yes, it is. So we don't cover it in this class, but there is a statistical law called Zipf's law, which applies to natural language and to a lot of other domains. It basically governs the distribution of individual occurrences of things like words in text, right? And Zipf's law says that out of all the possible words that you see, about half of them are going to occur only once, right? So if they occur only once, that means they're going to occur for the positive class but not for the negative. Or the other way around, they'll occur for the negative but not for the positive. So this problem, the problem of zero frequencies, it's all over the place. It's not a rare event. So if you do realistic modeling on emails, probably 70-80% of the words will have a zero frequency somewhere. It's scary, but it's true. Okay. So another thing is, it is Naive Bayes, so we are assuming word independence, and that means that each word in an email contributes sort of independently to the final score. So this leads to a specific. This leads to a specific way in which you could trick Naive Bayes classifiers. So that's called stuffing. So for example, if you're sending out a spam email, if you happen to add a lot of hammy